A production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. I'll bring the House Commerce Committee to order. I'd like to welcome everybody here today. I'd like to also welcome those that are listening over the internet. A friendly reminder to turn off your cell phones, turn off the sound on your computer so we don't have any disruptions this morning. Those that are going to testify, if you could please sign in as you come in the door there, get your name on the sign-in sheet. We have two pages with us today that just started on Monday. If you two could please stand up and introduce yourselves. Tell us where you're from.
I'm Aaron Johnson. I'm from Canton.
Welcome, Aaron.
I'm Brooke Anderson.
Welcome. If you have any information to be distributed to the committee, please do it through the pages. Have them take care of that. Personal note, you'll see many people wearing pink today. And real men do wear pink, just so you know. I'm going to read a note from Representative Sly. Many of us have been touched in some way by breast cancer, whether it has been at a personal level, someone we love, a friend, or an acquaintance. Pink ribbon is a common symbol of awareness to remind us of breast cancer. And she sent us a reminder to wear something pink on Wednesday, February 25th, to honor those who have fought the battle against breast cancer. Hence, that is why you see a number of us wearing pink today, including the chair. We'll get right into business this morning. First bill up is Senate Bill Number 8. It's an act to revise certain provisions relating to the promulgation of rules to set various licensing and other fees for certain professions and occupations. The chair will ask for proponent testimony. Oh, we need a roll call. Please start off with a roll call.
Blake?
Here.
Fargin. Greenfield. Jensen.
Here.
Kirschman. Krebs.
Here.
Nordstrom.
Here.
Nygaard. Pitts. Solem.
Here.
Solberg.
Here.
Dreyer.
Here.
Rounds.
Here. We have a quorum, and everybody has read the minutes. We have a motion from Representative Greenfield to approve the minutes, seconded by Representative Dreyer. Any discussion on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Minutes are so approved. Now we will get into the agenda. Thank you, Representative Kirschman, for finding Representative Fargin. Next week, it'll be Representative Solberg's responsibility to find him. We'll get into Senate bills now. Again, Senate Bill Number 8, Act to Revise Certain Provisions Relating to the Promulgation of Rules to Set Various Licensing and Other Fees for Certain Professions and Occupations. The chair will entertain proponent testimony in Senate Bill 8. Good morning, Representative Peters.
Good morning, Representative Rounds. I'm Representative Deb Peters, District 9 from Hartford. I'm just going to go, before I get into Senate Bill 8, I would like to go through some of the history of where this bill comes from. In government operations and audit, we have gone through all of the boards and commissions, and as a lot of you are familiar, maybe the new members aren't, but the Government Operations and Audit puts together a book every year about with other fund information, and typically a lot of those are boards and commissions throughout the state of South Dakota. When we first started this project about 4 years ago, we noticed that all of the boards and commissions in the state of South Dakota had all sorts of different statutes relating to fees and whether the statutes relate to minimums, maximums, whether some of them had no fees in statute, some did, some didn't. And so last year, Government Operations and Audit Committee put together an omnibus board and commissions bill. And it basically puts into statute the maximums and minimums of fees, makes it consistent based on all the boards and commissions, all the language is the same, for how the boards and commissions deal with fees in statute and in rule. And it passed last year, and this is the bill. It's about 34, 35 pages long, and it went through and really clarified the procedure for boards and commissions on how things need to go. Senate Bill 8 now is a continuation of that. Last year we had two boards and commissions that had one had a new executive director and the other one we had some issues with. And so Senate Bill 8 is now the continuation. We had to exempt the two two boards and commissions last year. It was the Electrical Commission and then the Board of Technical Professions. Those two were exempted in last year's bill. Senate Bill 8 is the same bill as last year, except includes the electricians and electrical contractors and also the Board of Technical Professions. If you have any specific questions in the bill, really all this is not raising any fees. This just puts into statute the maximums. They still have to go through rule in order to increase their fees. And once they hit their maximum, then they come back to the legislature to increase their maximums. But this does not in any way change their fees, and it's not raising fees. It's just putting into statute maximums, minimums, and also making the language consistent for rules and the procedures these boards and commissions have to go through for rule. And if, I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, if I might.
If you can have the pages distribute the amendment. And I'll allow testimony on the proposed amendment, and if there's any opponents, they can also testify to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, Amendment 8TA essentially just changes one number on page 2, line 16. There was a bit of a miscommunication that this fall the Electrical Commission had some changing in their executive director this fall when we were in the process of writing this bill. And in the transitions and things, this one line item was missed. So the Electric Commission, the executive director, Mr. Lynn, is here. He brought to our attention that this was missed in the process of the government operations and audit hearings this fall. And so with that, I would ask your approval of this particular amendment to ensure that we are not harming the Electrical Commission by putting into statute maximums of their fees.
Thank you, Representative Peters. Further proponents on Senate Bill 8? Are there any additional proponents on Senate Bill 8? Seeing none, are there any opponents on Senate Bill 8? Any opponents? Seeing no opponents, I will open it up to committee questions. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Krebs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Representative Peters. Representative Peterson, can you just briefly explain, for a lot of us that are newer, just explain the process that you put in last year's bill, or should say statute now, the rules and how they each board and commission must proceed to change their fees, so the rest of us all understand that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, I can sure attempt to make sure that I know how this works. Senator Gant and I have been kind of working together, but I've kind of push this off on him a little bit this year, so it's been a little while since I've looked at this. Essentially, currently the boards and commissions, I'm going to back up. I'm not going to talk about the old way it did work, because every board and commission is different. The new way, the way we're trying to make it work is we've put into statute the maximums for all the boards and commissions for all of their fees. So now the procedure that we've tried to put in place is that the boards and commissions go to the Rules Committee and justify the reasons why they are increasing their fees. Once the Board or Commission hits their maximum, they cannot go to rule once they've gone to the maximum. Rules will not allow them to go above their maximum set in statute. So then they have to come back to the legislature. They have to draft a bill. They have to convince every one of us to increase their maximum and that the maximum should be justified. And I hope that answers your question, Representative Krebs.
Representative Krebs, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think just for the committee's sake, that's what we have that rules committee for, mm-hmm. that meets throughout the year, is for that process. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. Our rules committee is going to help work with the day-to-day operations of the state outside of session.
Further questions of the committee? Further questions? Representative Blake.
Just one more. If they want a new fee, did they go through this process also, or if it's something that hasn't ever had a fee before, what
Mr.
do they?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Peters.
Yes, if it is not a fee that they've had in statute before, it is, and it will be a brand new fee under, let's say, the Electrical Commission, they'll have to come back in and institute the new fee put in a new maximum, and then go through rules. But they have to come see the legislature first.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing no further questions, I'll close it to public testimony, open it up to committee discussion and or action. I would like to, before we get into action on this bill, thank Representative Peters and Representative Gant and those that have worked specifically last year. That was a long bill. A lot of time was put into it as it made its way between the two chambers. A lot of discussion on it with a lot of hard work, so I'd like to commend them for their hard work on this. Further discussion and or action, Representative Dreyer.
Move to pass.
Motion to pass from Representative Dreyer, seconded by Representative
Substitute motion.
Krebs. We have a substitute motion.
I move Amendment 8TA.
Substitute motion by Representative Greenfield is to move ATA, which is deleting 200 and inserting 375 on page 2, line 6. That was seconded by Representative Fargin. Discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate Bill 8 is so amended. Now we do need a new motion for due pass on amended Senate Bill 8 as amended. Representative Dreyer.
Move due pass.
We have a motion, Representative Dreyer, due pass on Senate Bill 8 as amended, seconded by Representative Solberg. Comments on the due pass motion? Hearing none, the question is, do pass on Senate Bill 8 as amended. All those in favor will signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. The secretary will call the roll.
Lake.
Aye.
Fargin.
Aye.
Greenfield.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Kirschman.
Aye.
Krebs.
Aye.
Nordstrup.
Aye.
Pitts.
Aye.
Solberg.
Aye.
Solem.
Aye.
Dreyer.
Aye.
Rounds.
Aye.
Nygaard's not here.
Senate Bill 8 will move to the floor as amended. Thank you, Representative Peters. Second bill on today's agenda is Senate Bill 29. This is an act to revise the requirements for replacement or discontinuance of group life insurance policies. The chair will ask for proponent testimony on Senate Bill 29.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Randy Moses, Division of Insurance. Senate Bill 29 comes to you due to some situations that we became aware of where when employers had group health, group life insurance, pardon me, made a switch from one insurance company to another, and some employees fell through the cracks and were without group life insurance coverage. In fact, unfortunately, a couple situations where there was a death and the coverage was in question because of the switchover. We originally put this bill in to make that a responsibility of the replacing carrier. The insurance companies did not theoretically have any issue with trying to deal with the problem, but the way the bill, original bill was written was not the way they preferred to having it done. And so we ended up with a Hoghouse Amendment over on the other side on 29. What you'll find now is a bill that does still correct the problem but handles it in a little bit different way than originally intended. But let me go through some of the aspects of Senate Bill 29 in its current form. It does deal with a number of different issues on replacement of life insurance to provide some additional requirements that will come into play. For instance, carrier, the old carrier, is going to be liable for any valid claims prior to any written notice of discontinuance, and it also would require a 3-working day notice before the discontinuance of coverage can be effective. The insurance company has to provide a supply or at least access to notice forms to give them to the employers so they can get the notice to the employees, and the notices have to contain the effective date of the discontinuance of coverage, and urge employees to refer to their certificates for any rights of continuance of coverage that they may have. Real important point is that the policies must have a reasonable provision for extension of benefits in the event of total disability. So if an employee is totally disabled, the old carrier would have to extend coverage for that individual while they are still totally disabled. In addition to setting out some requirements when the coverage will end for the replacing carrier. It specifically says that the succeeding carrier can limit benefits to employees who are actively at work. But if the employee is disabled, then the prior carrier would provide the coverage. But if they're not disabled and not at work, but on approved leave of some sort or another, then they're considered actively at work, and then the new carrier would automatically take them. So about the only time somebody wouldn't be covered is if they're no longer an employee because they're quit or been terminated or something like that, or on an unauthorized leave of absence from the from their work. So this, by and large, will take care of that problem and does so in a manner that industry is comfortable with, and we'll stand by for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moses. Further proponent testimony on Senate Bill 29. Any further proponents? Seeing none, are there any opponents to Senate Bill 29? Are there any opponents? Seeing none, I will open it up to committee questions. Questions of the committee. Representative Solberg.
Thank you very much for Mr. Moses. If a company discontinues a policy with a carrier and then goes to another company, is it possible to drop some of the existing employees who remain with that company by the new carrier?
Moses.
Though it is possible that the employer could choose to alter who they want to cover. They could say, well, I only want to cover a certain class of employees from this date forward, and the employer could voluntarily choose to do that. The employees, if there was a disabled employee, they would certainly have an opportunity for extension of coverage. There's also a requirement for offering conversion of coverage for those employees if they don't have continuation coverage. So they would have some other choices, but it does not restrict employers to having the exact same coverage that they had before if they want to choose to buy a different type of policy.
Mr. Moses, just follow up on that same question. As it is today, do employers still have that same ability?
Yes, they do.
Prior to the passage.
Absolutely.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If someone was disabled and chose continuance of the insurance, would they be liable for the premiums then?
Yes, there would be some premium. Premium would have to be paid on the policy to continue that coverage in force.
Representative Solberg, you have one more follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the current time, who pays those premiums?
The premiums it depends on how the employer has set up. And there's, for instance, how it's traditionally done is there is a base policy for life insurance that's entirely employer paid. And then the employees can buy supplemental coverage to add to that, and the employee usually pays that out of their own pocket, but the employer usually pays the underneath portion is how it typically works. It's not required that it always work that way, but that's the general pattern.
Representative Solberg, does that answer your questions? If you have additional questions, go ahead. We have plenty of time. I want to make sure the questions are answered. Representative Blake, did you have a question? Anyone else have a question of the committee? Representative Blake, you're formulating some thoughts.
I'm just trying to make sure, thank you. I'm just trying to make sure that if people have had insurance and they've had some pre-existing condition or something happened to them during that time, and then the employer, because it's expensive to cover this person, wants to change policies and eliminate some of those people. I want to make sure that that can't happen. I don't know how to put that
Mr.
in question
Moses.
Form.
I'll try and address that. First of all, there would not be a rating of the employees by health condition for group life insurance. They would just rate them based on their age. So that I don't believe there would be any extra added incentive to try and put somebody off the policy, so to speak. But neither this bill nor the current law in any way makes any requirements on the employers to purchase any particular kind of life insurance coverage for their employees. So it is possible, like I indicated before, that an employer could choose to buy a different type of coverage and not cover everybody that they had previously covered based upon the class of business. But those situations are not where the new and life insurance company is going to underwrite the employees. They're just going to take the employees in mass. Whoever's a qualified employee for life insurance, they're going to take them. They're not going to sit down and individually underwrite them.
Reverend Blake, does that somewhat answer your question?
I think it does.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, please.
Proceed.
Mr. Moses, why would they do this? Just give me a scenario where they would.
An employer may, for whatever reason, decided that, economics dictate that they may want to reduce coverage and may not want to cover all their employees and restrict it just to management, for instance, and not cover everybody else or something like that. I'm not saying that that's typical. Matter of fact, I think that would be probably the exception rather than the rule.
Thank you.
Further questions of the committee? I guess now I'm trying to formulate a question. And I think presently the status quo is that an employer doesn't have to provide coverage. That is at their option. What this bill is doing is trying to clear up a gap should the employer change coverage, which presently doesn't exist.
That's exactly right, Representative Brown. That's exactly correct. It provides significant additional protection for employees that's not currently in law.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Solberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it not a federal law when a company offers health insurance to their people that it is and life insurance that it is available to all employees and they must deny it to be excluded?
Mr. Moses?
No, I don't believe that's accurate.
Further questions?
No.
Seeing none, I will close it to public testimony and open it up to committee discussion and or action. Representative Dreyer.
Move to pass.
We have a motion from Representative Dreyer to pass on Senate Bill 29, and it was seconded by Representative Fargan. Discussion on the do pass motion. Oh, is that Jensen? Oh. So that was Jensen. I've been throwing your voice. So we have a second by Representative Jensen. Comments on the do pass motion.
Just going to save us from formulating any more questions. We're digging deep into this, and I think we got a little bit I think we were starting to get a little bit off the topic, but I think it was some excellent questions, and I hope everybody got the questions answered. Delve into the rules of insurance. We could really pick Randy's brain, I think, with a lot of unanswered questions about the insurance business.
Further comments on the do pass motion? Representative Krebs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to Randy Moses for your patience in walking us through this committee, because it's hard to get your hands around insurance. But I think the clarification that Representative Solom and I were talking about is that this is life insurance versus health. And so the difference stands there, I think. And so it's hard to clarify that. But I think that's the biggest thing we need to remember here, is that we're talking about life insurance versus health insurance.
Further comments on the do pass motion? Seeing none, the question is do pass on Senate Bill 29. All those in favor will signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Blake?
Aye.
Fargan?
Aye.
Greenfield?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Kirschman?
Aye.
Krebs?
Aye.
Nordstrom?
Aye.
Nygaard? Pitts?
Aye.
Solberg?
Aye.
Solom?
Aye.
Dreyer?
Aye.
And Rounds?
Aye.
12.
House Bill, or Senate Bill 29 will move to the floor with the do pass recommendation. We have a motion consent from Representative Dreyer, seconded by Representative Greenfield. Any discussion on the consent motion? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Senate Bill 29 will move to the floor and be placed on the debate calendar. The consent motion fails. I think I'm going to ask Representative Dreyer if he would take the honors of Senate Bill 29 on the floor. Well, let's put it a different way. Representative Dreyer, you will carry Senate Bill 29 on the floor.
I see Representative Solberg rubbing his hands together over there.
Thank you. Next bill up is Senate Bill number 31, an act to revise certain labeling requirements for gasoline or gasoline blends. At this time, the chair will ask for proponent testimony on Senate Bill 31.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Dave Fehler with the Department of Public Safety, the Office of Weights and Measures. Senate Bill 31 would revise the requirements for labeling of the anti-knock index or octane rating of automotive fuels, that being the same thing. And thanks to Donna, the petroleum marketers, I can give you an example of what those octane ratings look like. You've seen them on all the dispensers out there. Why do we want to do this? Well, since 1953, South Dakota has had a statute on the books which basically has said that it's a little unclear whether it requires that you post octane. I think that would probably be debatable. But it does say that when you post it, it has to be actual. But it goes on to define actual as differing by no more than two octane numbers. Okay, so let's just use this 87 as an example. If you were a retailer and you got a manifest which indicated that it was 87 octane, according to our law, you could post that anywhere from 85 up to and including 89, and it would be satisfactory with our law. Well, what's the problem with that? Since 1979, the Federal Trade Commission has had a fuel rating rule. It was, I believe, formerly known as the octane rule, and it is specified requirements for rating determination, for certification, for posting, and record keeping for all liquid automotive fuels with the exception of diesel fuel. So this applies to refiners, importers, producers, distributors, and retailers of automotive fuel. They must comply with the fuel rating rule, and the FTC can sue violators in federal court and impose civil fines up to $10,000 per violation. Interestingly enough, they also have a preemption section in the fuel rating rule, which basically says that no state or anybody else for that matter may adopt a statute which is in conflict with the fuel rating rule. Well, I think it's quite clear that South Dakota's is in conflict with the fuel rating rule because we allow that plus or minus two. And what the fuel rating rule requires is that it has to be, your posted octane has to be equal to or less than that certified by the supplier. So, once again, 87 octane, that's what's certified by the supplier in the manifest or whatever documentation you have. Okay, you can post it as 87, you could post it as 86, but you could not post it as 87 and a half. Okay, so that's the difference, basically, and that's what we hope to do is basically change this statute so that we're adopting language that is consistent with the FTC fuel rating rule. We borrowed the language from the 2005 version of the National Institute of Standards and Technology Handbook 130, which is entitled Uniform Laws and Regulations in the Areas of Legal Metrology and Engine Fuel Quality. That particular document is adopted by the state of South Dakota, the 2005 version. And with that, I would be more than happy to answer any questions for you.
Thank you. Further proponents on Senate Bill 31.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Donna Lightskeith, South Dakota Petroleum and Propane Marketers Association. And I represent the people that put those decals on the dispensers. This is not an issue for us. Presently, they do label their octane correctly. As you know, we have several different blends of fuel in the state, and they are all very conscientious of that, and they want the consumers to know exactly what octane that is, because some people prefer premium, so they are looking for the 91 or 92 octane. So they presently do that, and we would hope you could support the agency in passing this bill. And I'll stand by for questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Further proponents on Senate Bill 31? Any further proponents? Seeing none, are there any opponents to Senate Bill 31? Are there any opponents? Seeing none, I will open it up to committee questions. Representative Greenfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know which one of you would prefer to answer this, but I think I have a couple questions. The first one, what happens if somebody is found to be out of compliance?
Once again, Dave Failer.
Identify yourself again, Mr. Failer.
Once again, Dave Failer, Department of Public Safety. My understanding is that, and I do have a little booklet in here that addresses those sorts of things. Actually, it's put out by the FTC, and it is how anybody basically complies with that particular rule. But in response directly to your question, I believe anybody could actually turn a violator into the FTC, and I think they basically say if the state becomes aware of it, they should turn the violator into the FTC, at which point they would take it. It would not be anything that we would pursue specifically.
Representative Greenfield, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My second question is, I'm going to take a moment to try to formulate my question.
Granted.
If the gas comes in below the octane requirement on the pump, is the retailer solely responsible, or would the jobber be responsible for delivering something that was lower in octane than what's indicated on the pump?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Fraser.
My understanding is there's really two different requirements here, and this is covered in different areas of the statute, but the retailer is required, the supplier is required to provide the appropriate information on a manifest or whatever that would identify that that octane, okay? And it has to be accurate. And once again, the FTC fuel rating rule applies to the supplier as well as the retailer. So I think in your particular case, what you were talking about is if they already have it labeled, but it comes in and the manifest says it's 85 and it's labeled on the pump as 87, at that point, they're being told what the actual octane is. It would be up to the retailer, I believe, to change that that sticker to read the appropriate octane, 85 in that case.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
I believe it does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Failer.
Don't go far. Representative Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either one of you could answer this question for me, but this closely follows along with what Representative Greenfield was talking about. And it may not be that restrictive in a smaller type station, but golly, if you get into a very busy truck stop or someone that pumps a lot of fuel, I could see the potential. You're receiving 10,000 gallon tankers on a daily basis, and it would be very hard for that retailer to stay in compliance if say each load of fuel, whether it's unleaded or whatever, would vary by maybe just even one point on your octane rating, and also you're not keeping those loads separate from one day to the next. I would assume they all go into the same big tank underground. And how is that dealer supposed to stay in compliance should that situation arise?
With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll turn that question over to Donna, because I think, well, okay, sure.
I think that'd be acceptable for you to work as a team, so.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solem, when the product comes off the pipeline, they follow ASTM standards from the refinery. So when I'm pulling, let's say, 100% unleaded off the pipeline, they've already refined it to around that point. When they're refining that, it's already basically 87 octane. So as we say in the industry, gas is gas. The thing that makes it different is a detergent package that's added. So all gas coming into any pipeline should all be consistent because the refiner has rules and regulations they have to follow to refine it to that. So when you're getting unleaded, you're getting 87. Now, not to open a can of worms, but in Rapid City or in the mountainous region, it's refined to 85. And that has, and Dave can probably extrapolate on that, but it has to do with elevation, why the difference is there. But 87 is 87, E10 is 89. When you blend that up, it becomes an 89. For our blender pumps in Watertown, I think E20 is 89.5 and E30 is 90.5. So there are standards when they refine that fuel. They don't just arbitrarily make different fuel. It basically should be all the same. I don't know if that answers that.
Representative Solem, does that help?
Yes, certainly. That answered my question. Thank you.
Representative Krebs, did you have a question? Representative Kirschenman.
To Dave, I think. The consumer has to just trust you that it's 87, but you're in charge of weight and measures. Do you have guys go out and test it? Because we don't have kits. We don't have a kit to check it when we gas up. And
Mr. Chairman? You're absolutely correct. There is certainly a matter of trust there. When we have a complaint, if we have a complaint, we would go out and test. Now, we do have some difficulties. There are normally, to utilize the correct method, the samples would have to be physically taken and shipped off to a laboratory to be analyzed. But there are also some electronic meters that are devised and are quite, I think most states would use those as a field test method and then follow that up with a laboratory analysis. But to answer your question, we've had very, very, very few complaints of that nature. So consequently, in the 4.5 years or so that I've been here, I think we've sent off one sample for octane determination.
That answer your question? Further questions of the committee? Representative Greenfield?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this will probably boil it all down. You know, it's kind of a trust me game all the way along, but you're convinced that there are controls in place, you know, at the refinery level and at the pipeline level that are going to guarantee the integrity of the product that's coming off the lines, correct?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Fahler?
Yes, I am.
Because, Mr. Chair, I understand what you're saying, and my parents being gas retailers, you know, we're sitting there, well, I kind of question what happens if. But if the proper controls are in place and you're convinced that they are, then there should be no problem.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions of the committee? Well, one question is, what could a retailer on the retailer end, what would or could a retailer do to, if they label it at 89, let's say they relabel it at 87, is there a history or any precedents in the past of somebody adding something to the fuel where it's actually an 83 or an 84? I mean, just curious, is there anything a retailer could do to change the...
Yeah, I think in response to your question, Mr. Chairman, that the only thing that I'm aware of, and is there a history of it, not really a history. We, one of the things that could change that octane rating, as Donna pointed out a minute ago, is ethanol. And you'll take 87 and add ethanol to it, alcohol, ethanol, and it is likely to raise that octane level. So that is a possibility, but that is also something that we have been spending some time looking into as well, particularly this last summer.
Okay, thank you. Representative Greenfield, you?
Well, just to expound on that, I don't think that the retailer would actually be doing that blending. I think that's something done by the supplier, you know, coming off the pipeline. So I don't think you would see that as a problem. This retailer certainly wouldn't have the wherewithal to do it.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fahler.
That's correct. By and large, what's happening is that is either being the blending is by and large done at the supplier level. There are a few out there that do their own blending, but by and large, it's blended when it gets they order it that way.
Okay, thank you,
Mr. Chairman. I just would like to add something. Maybe this will give you comfort level, but we're a very self-policing industry. And when someone's not doing something right, I get the call, and I make a call to Dave. We are close friends, and we do talk about this a lot. So if someone's doing something out there that they shouldn't be doing, they're going to get turned in, and it's usually me that's the person that does it anonymously. But we do work closely together because the last thing we need is fuel retailers, and Representative Greenfield knows this, is to get a bad rap or an onus on us that we're selling sub-octane or substandard fuel, and that's the last thing any of us want. So we're very self-policing in that, and they do, everybody just kind of watch out for each other, and we all know what's going on and who might not be doing something right. So,
okay, thank you. Further questions? I think Representative Greenfield, if there's ever a complaint, you know who the anonymous person was. Thank you very much. And at this time, I'm going to close it to public testimony and open it up to committee discussion and or action. Representative Greenfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move do pass.
Motion, Representative Greenfield, do pass. Seconded by Representative Kirschenman. Discussion on the do pass motion.
Mr. Chair. Thank you,
Representative
Mr. Chairman.
Greenfield.
This is a good bill, no doubt about it. I asked a couple questions. I didn't intend to sidetrack progress. I did have a couple, you know, things that I needed clarified in my own mind. Just being a part of the industry, so to speak, but clearly, as has been stated by Ms. Lightsky, their self-policing industry, she's here asking for this to be done, you know, so as to keep the standard high. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I encourage the committee to vote in favor of this. Do pass motion.
Thank you, Representative Greenfield. Further comments, Representative Fargin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that this is also a problem, and I know she touched on ethanol being used to increase the octane. I know down in Texas they were having some problems with people with blender licenses adding more ethanol of it to make it E30, taking the blender tax, pocketing it, and putting it out there as unleaded, and in turn have higher octane ratings but are not promoting ethanol and are pocketing the incentives of using ethanol in there. So I just want to make sure this is clear. I really support this bill also.
Thank you, Representative Fargin. Further, Representative Krebs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I commend the brilliance of this committee and the Commerce Committee. Typically, weights and measures goes to the esteemed Transportation Committee, and since I guess we might not have shown our brilliance in this committee, this is why this bill is here. So I was somewhat disappointed that I didn't get to hear it in Transportation, but glad I was a part of this because we've always heard weights and measures in Transportation. But I'm just so excited that we now all understand the legal metrology that our state deals with on the fuels in South Dakota.
And thank you, Representative Krebs. I think I commented first day of committee meetings that we see a wide variety of legislation up here because we are the committee that knows it all. And I take a lot of pride in that. Further comments on the do pass motion? Hearing none, the question is, do pass on Senate Bill 31. All those in favor will signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Blake?
Aye.
Fargin?
Aye.
Greenfield?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Kirschman? Krebs?
Aye.
Nordstrom?
Aye.
Nygaard? Pitts?
Aye.
Solberg?
Aye.
Solem?
Aye.
Dreyer?
Aye.
And Rounds?
Aye.
12-0.
Senate Bill 31 will move to the floor. The do pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenfield?
Consent.
We have a motion consent from Representative Greenfield, seconded by Representative Fargin. Discussion on the consent motion. Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. House Bill or Senate Bill 31 will move to the floor. Do pass recommendation and placed on consent calendar. And Representative Greenfield, you will be the one responsible for answering questions in caucus and on the floor. Representative Fargin, why don't you just make sure your folks understand it? Thank you. I'm going to hand the mallet over to Representative Dreyer. He will be the chair on the next bill.
Next up on the agenda, we have Senate Bill number 22, an act to authorize counties to borrow funds for the construction and operation of solid waste management facilities through the issuance of revenue bonds and set rates in the amount sufficient to retire the bonds. We'll open up with proponents for House Bill number Senate Bill number 22.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Templeton. I work for the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. As the chairman says, I'm here to present Senate Bill 22 to you, which is a bill to allow the counties to borrow funds for solid waste management facilities by issuing revenue bonds. In statutes, counties clearly have a lot of statutes or a lot of authority regarding solid waste management. They can own, operate, construct solid waste management facilities. In fact, we have some counties that own and operate regional solid waste landfills, and those counties are Roberts County, Brown County, and Walworth County. We have a couple counties, Lincoln and Tripp, which own and operate solid waste transfer stations. And this is where you gather the solid waste and then you ship it to a regional landfill. Unfortunately, DNR's legal counsel has advised us that while counties can receive grant funds for solid waste management activities, they cannot borrow funds. There's no statutory authority to borrow funds for solid waste management facilities. This concerns the department because our Board of Water and Natural Resources, they operate a solid waste grant and loan program. And this grant and loan program is commonly accessed by municipalities, counties, and private enterprise. To date, DNR, or our board, has been able to provide only grants to these counties that I mentioned above. And the non-county facilities, our board will commonly package a grant and loan funding package to based on the facilities or the applicant's ability to finance the project. Now, if I'd like to go to the bill, on Section 1 of the bill, this adds a new section to Chapter 7-33, which is the area of the county statutes dealing with solid waste facilities. And Section 1 would allow counties to borrow funds by issuing revenue bonds. The references to Chapter 9-40, and that's on line 13 on page 1, that's referring to a statute in the municipal code that deals with borrowing procedures to be followed when you issue revenue bonds. The reference to 34A6 is in the environmental section. There's about half dozen or so statutes that deal with counties and their responsibilities regarding solid waste. The reference to Chapter 6-8B on line 14, that references the how-to section when you issue revenue bonds. Now, jumping to Section 2 of the bill, that adds a new section which allows counties to establish rates sufficient to operate their solid waste facilities and to pledge the net revenues of those proceeds to repay any revenue bonds if they would issue them pursuant to Section 1 of the bill. And finally, Section 3 of the bill adds a new section to Chapter 7-33, which obligates the county to set solid waste rates in amount sufficient to operate and maintain the facility and to repay the revenue bonds. Senate Bill 22 is permissive legislation which gives the counties an additional financing option regarding solid waste. It gives our board an additional financing option regarding their lending of or granting of solid waste funds to their board. And I would hope the committee could support the bill. And that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I would stand by for questions.
Thank you. Any further proponents for Senate Bill 22?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Bob Wilcox with the County Commission Association. And as Mr. Templeton has indicated, this will give counties a tool that will gives us the flexibility in financing our solid waste facilities. And along with that, it is permissive legislation. And certainly we would ask you to support Senate Bill 22 as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further proponents for Senate Bill 22? Seeing none, any opponents for Senate Bill 22? Seeing none, we'll open it up to committee questions. Representative Krebs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Dave. Dave, can you just clarify for us how did the counties and the municipalities handle this previously?
There's 15, well, regarding the solid waste landfills, regional landfills, there's 15 of those. Some are operated by municipalities, some are operated by counties. Some of them are in joint powers. Some of them are in recycling waste management districts. But previous to this, the counties, if they were going to finance facilities, they would either come to our board, and we would have to, our board would have to give them all grant funds, or they would have to build up a sufficient cash reserve in order to pay for whatever they their new project.
Any further questions for proponents of Senate Bill 22? Seeing none, we'll open it up to committee discussion and or action. Representative Krebs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Move do pass on Senate Bill 31.
Second.
Motion do pass on Senate Bill 22, seconded by Representative Solem. Any discussion on the motion?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I guess we're going to make some comments here to stall because we're waiting on our next person. So I guess I didn't even realize that this was one of these options out here. And obviously this is something that we all are learning as we go out here as legislators. We typically learn on all different levels in municipalities and counties and how some of these things work. So when you drive by some of these solid waste management sites, now we know and we are enlightened in how the process works. I didn't realize it was a grant funding before or cash reserve funding, but this just seems to be that in the county's budgets are extremely tight right now. So this obviously gives them the opportunity to fund through bonding.
Spoken like a true politician. Excellent. Any further comments on the action do pass on Senate Bill 22? Seeing none, Secretary will please call the roll.
Blake?
Aye.
Fargin?
Aye.
Greenfield?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Kirschman?
Aye.
Krebs?
Aye.
Nerstrup?
Aye.
Pitts?
Aye.
Solberg?
Aye.
Solem?
Aye.
Dreyer?
Aye.
And Rounds. It's 12-0.
Senate Bill 22 heads to the floor, do pass, unanimous votes. Representative, motion due consent by Representative Krebs, seconded by Representative Greenfield. All those in favor will signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And it will head to the consent calendar, Senate Bill 22. Representative Nordstrom, if you could answer any questions in committee and on the floor on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Next up on our agenda today, I see our sponsor is here, so we can proceed, is Senate Bill 84, an act to revise certain provisions relating to the collateral real estate mortgages. This time the chair will ask for proponent testimony on Senate Bill 84.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Lust, House of Representatives, District 34. I'm here today to discuss Senate Bill 84, and what Senate Bill 84 does is addresses some revisions that need to be made to collateral real estate mortgage statutes, or collateral real estate mortgage, or CREM, is different than your typical mortgage in that it allows for the fluctuation of the indebtedness down to zero, but does not extinguish your lien. You customarily see them with lines of credit. For example, if I were to have a line of credit and my lender took out a CREM as collateral, what would happen is if I borrowed $200,000, paid it down to zero, the bank's lien does not go away on that property. And it allows me thereby to build that line of credit or borrow from that line of credit, draw on it up to another $100,000 without impacting the security position of the bank. So it's a flexible device to allow really floating of debt down to zero and then back up again so that the lender doesn't have to issue a new mortgage when the debt gets down to zero, cancel the existing one, issue a new one. And that's customarily where you see it. What we've seen and the problems that have arisen in the existing statutes are that CREMs, as they're currently used, if one thing I don't like about CREMs, and that's not going to go away by this bill, is that they expire after 5 years. So it always causes me heartburn whenever I, as an attorney, use a CRIM because there's that deadline. If you blow it, you've potentially significantly injured your client's interest. So you have to constantly maintain your calendar and make sure that you meet that five-year deadline. And I'm always concerned that it's never happened to me, but I've heard of stories where the deadline's been missed and it causes all sorts of problems. But what happens when it lapses, when a CRIM lapses now after 5 years and it's not renewed for whatever reason, is it terminates both the mortgage and it terminates the lien interest. And that's not true of a UCC financing statement. And the UCC financing statement, which is the tandem, if you will, on personal property, it's a way to secure an interest in personal property. Mortgages secure an interest in property, real property, and a financing statement secure an interest in other tangibles, personal property primarily. And on the UCC side, what happens when and it still has a five-year deadline, when that expires, it doesn't extinguish the interest between the creditor and the borrower. It just extinguishes as to other creditors. That's not true right now with CRIMs. What happens with the CRIM is if you miss your deadline, you're out of luck. Not only does it become invalid against your borrower, it also becomes invalid against other creditors in a priority situation. It's fine as concerns other creditors, but it should not, simply because you missed the deadline, should not expire your interest with your borrower. So this bill seeks to remedy this situation. In addition, it also seeks to fix a situation where if you have a maturity date of a promissory note in your CRIM and that maturity date passes on the note, it doesn't extinguish your security interest again. And an example there is what I used earlier, where maybe you have a note for $100,000 that expires in a year. It would be customary in the ag community. The note comes and passes, and the maturity date happens to be in the mortgage. Probably not a good practice, but say it's in the CRIM. And that mortgage date comes and goes. The CRIM expires because the maturity date is in there. But the bank's interest in that collateral really should not have expired because it'll spring forward again when the farmer borrows another $100,000 for the next crop year. So this bill, Senate 84, seeks to rectify those situations, not to injure other creditors in the priority situation, but to keep in place that CRIM as it concerns the lender and the borrower. So it seeks to clarify those issues and in some respects make it similar to the UCC. And with that, I will stand by for questions.
Thank you, Representative Lust. Further proponents on Senate Bill 84? Any additional proponents? Seeing none, are there any opponents to Senate Bill 84? Any opponents? Seeing none, I will open it up to committee questions. Representative Krebs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Representative Lust. I understand the protection here for the creditors, but I also want to go back to the consumer. For a small business owner like myself that opened up an open line of credit, one time necessary and needed it, pay off, what's the protection for the consumer then that lien is off of my record saying that it's paid off, say on a house or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That's a good question. Right now, if you have a CRIM in your example and you have a $200,000 line of credit, you pay it down to zero and you want the CRIM removed, you can require that of the lender right now. This statute does not change that.
Representative Krebs, follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just helping clarify for me and maybe others as well. So currently in statute, I still have to request that, or does it naturally come off?
Representative Lost.
It would. Most banks have a procedure whereby they would satisfy that mortgage. If they did not, you would request it of lender. I have run into situations where you get kind of a rogue mortgage out there that hasn't expired. The satisfaction didn't get filed for some reason. And I've not found a lender that at all resists. In fact, legally, they couldn't not file it. They have no basis for maintaining that collateral interest anymore because the debt has been paid.
Correct.
Representative Krebs.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thanks for clarifying that, Representative Lust, because I think that's the key word is, you know, do they by statute have to satisfactorily file that to clarify that it has been paid off? And then my question was, is that does that go away at that point? And I think you clarified that for me. So thank you, Representative West.
Thank you. Further questions of the committee? I think I'll ask one. During your testimony, you said something about the other creditors not being worried. I think the fact that they're not here today testifying on this says that there's not a big worry out there in the financial world on that situation, on this bill, because they're not here testifying. I think that speaks volumes. Further questions? I guess that wasn't a question. That was a statement. But you agree with that?
I would agree.
Thank you. I needed an answer. Representative Solberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lust, if you have secondary creditors, give me an example of those.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Very good question. What you customarily see is CREMs are usually not the first priority position. You customarily see them as second positions, but it would be an example of, say, you're a commercial enterprise. You would have a first mortgage to a bank, and then you go and borrow using the equity of your assets, a building and property. You would go borrow from another lender who may then put a CREM on it. And then perhaps you get some judgment liens, perhaps you borrow further, get a third mortgage. So they're junior to the CREM. And right now when that CREM expires, this bill and the current status of it, you lose your priority. That lender that had the CREM loses its priority when it expires. This bill fixes the situation where just because it expired doesn't mean you lose your security interest with your customer, your debtor. So it doesn't. This won't impact other lien creditors, junior lien creditors, or senior lien creditors under any circumstance.
Representative Solberg, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What protects the first lien holder, the bank, under your scenario if they go get a CREM from one, another CREM?
Very good question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lost.
As a first priority creditor, you're really bulletproof. So anything that happens below you is really none of your concern. You sometimes see some mortgages that prohibit further encumbrance of a piece of property. So that would be the bank's first line defense. If you didn't want any other encumbrance on that property, you could put that in your mortgage. But generally, when you're in first position, you frankly don't care what happens below you because you're safe.
Representative Solberg, the answer here, you got a follow up.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your patience. Why would somebody that has a loan with Bank ABC want to go to another financial institution to get a CREM?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lost.
It's a good question. It happens all the time. You may get a better rate. You may have a different relationship. You may have maxed out your, frankly, welcomeness with the first bank. There are a host of different reasons, and you may use a national. Sometimes you'll see a professional will use a local bank as the first line, and then they'll use a boutique lender, say a dentist or something, can go on a national lender who borrows only to dentists, and you may do something like that.
Representative Solberg, further questions of the committee? Representative Krebs?
Chair. Representative Lux, can you tell me where this stemmed from? Obviously, this legislation was spurred by probably some of the work that you do, because I know you work in this area. So can you give us the relationship of what happened?
The bill came from, I think, Senator Knutson's, some of his circles in Sioux Falls that recognize that this is an issue. And it resonated with me because I've seen it as well. It wasn't the type of thing that I'm going to jump up and scream about and say this has to be changed. Because it hasn't impacted my personal practice. But I think there's been some concerns in the legal community and on both sides of the state that this is something that really does it service to no one the way it currently exists. And this will ensure that lenders don't lose their interest with their debtor just because their CREM expires.
Further questions of the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Representative Lust. I'm going to close it to public testimony, open it up to committee discussion and or action. Any discussion and or action on Senate Bill 84? Representative Dreyer.
Move to pass.
Second.
Motion by Representative Dreyer, do pass, and Senate Bill 84, seconded by Representative Krebs. Discussion on the do pass motion. Representative Dreyer? Any discussion on the do pass motion? Seeing none, the question is, do pass on Senate Bill 84? All those in favor will signify by saying aye. Those opposed, nay. Secretary will call the roll.
Blake?
Aye.
Bargeon?
Aye.
Greenfield?
Yes.
Jensen?
Aye.
Kirschman?
Aye.
Krebs?
Aye.
Excuse me. Nordstrom?
Aye.
Pitts?
Aye.
Solberg?
Aye.
Solem?
Aye.
Dreyer?
Aye.
Rounds?
Aye.
12-0.
Senate Bill 84 will move to the floor. Be placed on the calendar, do pass. We have a motion consent. Representative Dreyer, seconded by Representative Fargeon. Discussion on the consent motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenfield.
Well, I'd just encourage you to support this motion as it will keep Representative Lust from testifying on the floor.
For further comments on the consent motion, hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate Bill 84 will be placed on the consent calendar. Thank you, Representative Lust.
You don't have to go anywhere, do you?
Take it.
Next bill, Senate Bill 61. An act to update certain citations for federal regulations regarding pipeline safety inspection. We'll go ahead and open it up to proponents of Senate Bill 61.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Relaine Wiest, and I'm an attorney with the Public Utilities Commission. And Senate Bill 61 just updates the citations to our federal regulation and laws concerning our pipeline safety inspection program. The dates just changed from 2007 to 2009. These are the only changes that have been made. And with these updates, what the commission, our pipeline safety inspectors, will be able to do is we'll be able to enforce any changes that have been made to the federal laws between 2007 and 2009. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further proponents for Senate Bill 61? Seeing none, any opponents for Senate Bill 61? Seeing none, we'll open it up to committee questions. Any questions on Senate Bill 61? Representative Blake.
For Relaine, do you know what changes there are from 2007 to 2009? Have there been a lot?
Mr. Chairman? I did ask our pipeline safety inspector, and he did give me some examples. Some of the examples would increase some of the regulations, and some perhaps would lessen some of them, but I can just, you know, give you one example. One of the changes is to the design and construction standards to reduce internal corrosion. There are also standards for increasing the maximum allowable operating pressure for gas transmission pipelines.
Any follow-ups? Any further questions? Senate Bill 61. Seeing none, we'll open it up to committee action and or discussion. Representative Krebs. Move do pass by Representative Krebs, second by Representative Blake. Any discussion on the action? Seeing none, Secretary will please call the roll.
Blake.
Aye.
Bargeon.
Aye.
Greenfield.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Kirschman.
Aye.
Krebs.
Aye.
Nordstrom.
Aye.
Pitts.
Aye.
Solberg.
Aye.
Solem.
Aye.
Dreyer.
Aye.
Rounds.
Aye.
12-0.
Senate Bill 61 passes. Move to the floor. Vote 12-0.
Second.
Move for consent. Representative Round, second by Representative Greenfield. Any discussion on the consent action? All those in favor will signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
And Representative Blake, you'll be responsible for answering questions on the floor, should there be questions. I'll take it and I'll give it to Jensen to answer questions in caucus. Well, that takes care of our calendar for this morning. As you all can see, we went through 2, 4, 6 bills today in a matter of an hour and 12 minutes. That's pretty good for this committee, considering the wide variety of topics we had today. Coming up on, do you have my list? Coming up on Monday of next week, I've got 4 bills that I'm going to post for Monday, so it gives you something to read while you're snowed into Pure tomorrow. The 4 bills are Senate Bills 128, 133, 187, and 136. Some of you may have committees that do not have a lot to do right now because there are not a lot of Senate bills over here. We do have, we had over 20 Senate bills that were assigned to this committee. We're taking care of them as we go. We're going to probably have 3 or 4 more to do next Wednesday. Then hopefully we'll be clearing our calendar in here. And for that reason, I want you to start thinking of ideas for summer studies. In a couple of weeks, we'll have a meeting in which we will spend some time talking about potential summer studies that we may want to support. If we decide to, as a committee, to recommend a summer study, it would be then forwarded to the e-board once they're selected, and there will be a process there as to which summer studies will be held. But we'll spend some time talking about that, but start thinking of some ideas for a summer study. I know we discussed yesterday the possibility of one, but there's no limit as to what we can submit. There is a limit as to what the e-board can approve. A couple of reminders. Next Wednesday is Packer Day here in the Capitol. You're going to So just remind all you Packer fans to wear your Packer ties and cheese heads. As you can tell, we are at the end, and I'm waiting for that proverbial Representative Krebs. We have a motion to adjourn from Representative Krebs, seconded by, I'll pick one out over there, Representative Jensen. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. We are adjourned.